actor is moving forward in its description, especially of the creation, because Maitreya Muni is speaking, responding to the questions of Vidura about the creation. And previously, earlier in this canto, he's described this creation, and now he's going to continue doing it. He's going to describe it again. This is the third time, and then there'll be a fourth time where the creation is described, process of creation, with the Lord as the center. The fourth time will be in the teachings of Kapila Muni, the son of Devahuti and the son of Kodama Muni. So here, what's happened prior to this, in the immediate chapters prior, after the last time the creation was described, earlier, possibly around the 12th chapter in this canto, then the Visarga. First Sarga and then Visarga is described. Atra Sarga Visarga Cha Stanam Poshanam Utaya Manvatara Ishanagata Naroda Mukti Asraya. These are the 10 topics of the Srimad Bhagavatam. So the first two are Sarga and Visarga, the primary and the secondary creation. The primary creation means when Krishna, through Mahavishnu, how he creates all the different elements, more or less assembles all the ingredients of the universe. That is called the Sarga, or the primary creation. In the same way, everything that we see in this world has as its primary creator Krishna. We see this house, or that house, or some huge office building, or a train system. So we ask, who has made that? And the reply will be this set of engineers and this construction company and the state government or the federal government or something like that. But where did the ingredients come from? Without the ingredients being supplied, without the wood, without the iron, without the steel, without the different resins, without these things being supplied, what can anyone create? Nothing. So out of the two creators, the primary creator and the secondary creator, the primary creator is more important, because the primary creator supplies the ingredients. And without the ingredients, a secondary creator can do nothing. So the primary creator, the Atra creator, is described in the Bhagavatam as the Lord, either Lord Narayan, Lord Vishnu, or ultimately Krishna Stuvaran Sayam, Krishna himself. He's the Sarva Karana Karanam. He's the cause of all causes. He's the original creator. So after that original creation was done, first, there was only the Lord, because this is what it means to be God. This is what we mean when we say the absolute truth. The absolute truth means that he is independent, he is satantra, and everyone else is paritantra. Everyone else and everything else is dependent upon him. Every other truth, every other relationship is dependent upon him ultimately. Nothing, no one is independent except for him. So tantra means independent. So he starts everything off. Before anything existed, he existed. And then by his potencies, everything expands. Well, we won't discuss it exactly now, but because we're going to hear about it again later on. But then, at a certain point, Lord Brahma is created. And we hear, even in this segment, how he comes. He's born out of the lotus, the navel. Lotus flower grows upon the navel of Gobadaksha Vishnu. and Lord Brahma is born. We heard this in the second canto too. And then Lord Brahma takes the ingredients after being inspired by Krishna, not only inspired, but actually empowered by Krishna, because no one can do something very wonderful without being empowered. We may have the inspiration to do something, but unless the ability and energy to successfully complete it comes, we cannot do it. So Brahma was empowered by Krishna to create. So in the earlier chapters, again possibly chapter 12, we heard how Brahma first created the four Kumaras. Later on we heard how the four Kumaras went to the Vaikuntha planets. And then after the four Kumaras wouldn't get involved in populating the universe, then Lord Brahma became angry and the four Kumaras were born. And then the ten sages were born, and on and on and on, ignorance came like that. And he had a daughter named Vak. So many different things happened. And then, when the creation wasn't proceeding quickly enough, he created Svayambhuva Manu and Satyarupa. And then, as we remember, and we discussed this last week, then they needed a place. They were very happy to serve their father, Lord Brahma, and they were ready to populate the earth. But where was the earth? It had fallen in the Garbhodak ocean. So then Lord Varaha took his birth from the nostril of the Lord. Someone would say, well, that is amazing, that God came from the nostril of the Lord, of Brahma. But when you think about it, is anyone's nostril a place where God isn't? Is that the only place in creation where God doesn't exist? If we think that it's odd that God was in the nostril of Lord Brahma, he is in the nostril. He's in your nostril too. He's in everyone's nostril. He's everywhere. There is no nostril in which he doesn't exist, and any other place too. He's everywhere. So, and since he can do anything he wants, this is how he chose to create a wonderful pastime. So Lord Varaha came out, and then he lifted up the earth. He fought with Haranyaka, and then Vidura asked what was the cause of the enmity, and we heard about the pregnancy of Diti, and how the two were in the womb, Haranyaksha, and were placed in the womb by Kashyapa Muni. Haranyaksha and Haranyakashipu, and then we heard of who these powerful personalities were, how Jai and Vijay were cursed by the Kumaras. And then after that entire tale, wonderful pastime of the Lord, the pastime of Varaha's birth is so wonderful, and the pastime of the four Kumaras finally seeing Lord Narayan is so wonderful. And then after hearing this, because who is hearing it? The sages of Namasharanya hearing this from Sutta Goswami. And Sutta Goswami is telling how Maitreya is explaining this to Vidura. So after hearing how Haranyaka was killed by the Lord Varaha, Sutta Goswami, Shonaka inquired. So Shonaka, the head of all the sages of Namasharanya, he said, "O Sutta Goswami, after the earth was again situated in its orbit, who placed it there? It was Varahadev. What did Svayambhuva Manu do to show the path of liberation to persons who were to take birth later on?" So Svayambhuva Manu was going to populate the earth, so he's asking for what happened next, basically. And the question is phrased in a very intelligent and far-seeing way. He said, how did he act in such a way to show the path of liberation to those who would later take their birth? Because he was going to cause population, the cause of further population in this world. But what is the purpose of population being in this world? Is it so that everyone can eat drink and be merry and then die? No, it is to get knowledge ultimately that will bring us liberation. To get ultimately bhakti, love for Krishna that will take us out of the material world. Liberation, the most wonderful kind of liberation. So he asked, how did Swayambhuva Manu act in such a way that the people on the planet would be shown the path of liberation? Then he inquired, so this, again, this is Shonaka Rishi speaking to Suta Goswami, and then he brings, so that's in the two levels down in the story, because there's the Vidura level, and then below that there is the what's going on with Brahma, and Brahma and Swayambhuva Manu and the creation. So then, after asking about the most immediate level, the deepest level, the level of Swayambhuva Manu, then he asked about Vidura. And he very briefly recounted how Vidura had gone on pilgrimage, because, very interestingly, because Vidura, even though a great soul, was entangled in materialistic activities due to him being in the court of Dhritarashtra and Duryodhana. And he felt impure because of that. Because Duryodhana especially was inimical to Krishna, and he would not go along with Krishna's plans. He was too ambitious. He wanted the kingdom for himself. He wanted to completely cut out the Pandavas. So he felt himself very contaminated by associating with such people, and therefore he went on pilgrimage to purify himself. Now, how does going on pilgrimage purify you? There are two ways. Of course, there are many reasons why it purifies. But the basic idea is that one has to leave one's the life that which in which one is entangled in. And it's very interesting when you go away, you know, you have so many things that you really feel like you really need, and then you go away for a few weeks or a few months and you come back and everything looks so unfamiliar and you realize that you didn't need any of it. That happened to me, not exactly in that reference, but I was living in a place, Gitanagari, and I left. And I had to leave fairly quickly. And I packed up many of my possessions, the things I couldn't take with me, like 10 trunks. And I stored them in somebody's house. And I didn't go back and see them for maybe 7, 8, 9 years. I didn't see them. And then when I finally looked at them, what was in there, nothing had any value. I didn't need any of it. And I thought they're all such important things for me. So when we go on pilgrimage, it is to break the attachments that we have to matter. And on the other hand, we go to holy places. Pilgrimages are done to holy places. And what is supposed to happen in a holy place? The place is holy because something happened there. Something wonderful happened there, having to do with the Lord and his pastimes, or something to do with the Lord's devotees. So we become attracted to the Lord. And generally there are bodies of water there, so we bathe there. But the real essence of the pilgrimage is to associate with holy people very deeply. Because lava matra sarasange sarasidiyo. It means there is a transmission when we associate with advanced devotees. A transmission comes from their heart and we can absorb that, and that is what we want. What is that coming from the heart? It's a taste. We want to have the taste that they have. Sushusho Sradhanasya Vasudeva Kataruchi. That's the taste. A taste to be absorbed in Krishna consciousness. Because now we want to lose the tastes for all those things we put in the trunks when we move somewhere. We want to lose the taste from that because we're going to lose those things anyway. We must lose those things. We must leave those things behind. So the intelligent person breaks the attachment before he's forced to break the attachment. Knowing that he's going to have to break the attachment, he willingly does it. Or the most intelligent person, knowing that he's going to have to, the attachment's going to be ripped from him, he never even develops attachments. That's the most intelligent person. He doesn't bother. But everyone can't live in that way, so at least if we get entangled, and most of us get entangled in some material things, before we leave this world, we voluntarily give them up and perform austerities. Therefore, the vanaprastha life is meant specifically for austerity. But we break the attachments, and therefore with the attachments broken, it's so much easier to gain the attachment for Krishna, the association of the devotees, and getting that taste that will stay with us, that we can keep with us, even when the body falls down. Today I went to the King's Park, and when you go to King's Park, it's such a big park, but one of the striking things is by all the trees they have these plaques, yeah, saying for the Australian soldiers who died in World War I and World War II and things like that. On one hand, it's very, very sad because these 18-year-old boys just in 1918 or 1920 or something, they're in Europe somewhere and they died in action or died of wounds or died of this or died of that. So it's very sad. But on the other hand, they're living now somewhere else. Because they did not die and the body died. So where are they now? Where are they now? Where is the soul? Now, it depends what they were thinking of at the time of death. If they were thinking of their pet kangaroos, well, if they were thinking of their dearly beloved wife or mom or father or children or something, or maybe that pet dog, or maybe they were just terrified of something in their mind, grasped onto something. So we practice in life, we practice holding on to Krishna, because there are so many minor traumas every day. Walking across the street, getting your exams back, the results of your exams and stuff. Well, it's traumatic. They put you in anxiety, or sometimes you have a close call, or you slip or fall, or twist your ankle, or this or that. Or someone criticizes you, or you lose money, or you gain money. So all these things, the good and the bad, they're all practices for grasping onto Krishna in the bad times and the good. Because how well we've practiced will be tested. So Vidura, to get purified from what he thought were material contaminations, he left the palace and he went on Prikrama. And he was a great, great, great devotee. And he was purified. And we heard about this right at the beginning of the canto. He met Uddhava. And Uddhava sent him to see Maitreya Muni and hear from him what Krishna explained. So there Vidura inquired. So Shanaka Rishi is mentioning this again at this point. And then he says, what more did Vidura inquire from Maitreya? So that's text 4. Prabhupada explains in the purport. Here the word Virajas Tirtha Sevaya refer to Vidura, who was completely cleansed of all contamination by traveling to places of pilgrimage. In India, there are hundreds of sacred places of pilgrimage, of which Prayag, Haridwar, Vrindavan, and Rameshwaram are considered principal. After leaving his home, which was full of politics and diplomacy, Vidura wanted to purify himself by traveling to all the sacred places, which are so situated that anyone who goes there automatically becomes purified. This is especially true in Vrindavan. Any person may go there, and even if he is sinful, he will at once contact an atmosphere of spiritual life and will automatically chant the names of Krishna and Radha. Prabhupada continues, that we have actually seen and experienced. It is recommended in the Shastras that after retiring from active life and accepting the Vanaprastha retired order, one should travel everywhere to places of pilgrimage, because when you're traveling, you're limited in what you can take with you. So you have to automatically be more austere. You don't have all the conveniences. You have to be tolerant. You have to accept whatever you get. So much learning is there in that. So one should travel everywhere to places of pilgrimage in order to purify himself. Vidura completely discharged his duty, and at last he reached Kushavarta, or Haridwar, where the sage Maitreya was sitting. Another significant point is that one must go to sacred places not only to take bath there, but to search out great sages like Maitreya and take instructions from them. If one does not do so, his traveling to places of pilgrimage is simply a waste of time. Narottama Das Thakur, a great acharya of the Vaishnava sect, has for the present forbidden us to go to such places of pilgrimage, because in this age, the times have so changed, a sincere person may have a different impression on seeing the behavior of the present residents of the pilgrimage sites. Even when Mahaprabhu went to Gaya, he went to the Vishnupad temple, the temple of Lord Vishnu, with the footprint of Lord Vishnu there, to offer pinda for his father who had departed from this world, to offer some ceremony for his father. And the pandits gave him, the local priests gave him trouble. They were bothering him for money. So if they bother Mahaprabhu, the residents will bother everyone in one way or another. So Narottama Das Thakur has said, don't go to any pilgrimage places. You go so far. If you're in Bengal, the Ganga is there, but you want to go to Badrinath or something. You want to go to Gangotri to see the Ganga, but the same Ganga is there. So he says, don't go to any pilgrimage places, but just accept the essence of the place of pilgrimage. And what is that? Taking shelter of Govinda. Because otherwise, he's saying that Prabhupada is explaining here, people get confused by all the disparities of different things going on. So he has recommended that instead of taking the trouble to travel to such places, one should concentrate his mind on Govinda. So it's interesting how Prabhupada, in the beginning of the purport, he said how wonderful Vrindavan is, or holy places, because if you just go there, even if you're a materialist, you'll be chanting and the spiritual atmosphere is so powerful. So immediately we all want to go to Vrindavan. And then the next thing he says is, you shouldn't go anywhere. Don't go to pilgrimage places, you'll get confused. Just take shelter of Govinda. And concentrate your mind on Govinda, and that will help. Of course, to concentrate one's mind on Govinda in any place is a path meant for those who are most spiritually advanced. It is not for ordinary persons. Ordinary persons may still derive benefit from traveling to holy places like Prayag, Mathura, Vrindavan, and Haridwar. So Prabhupada gave it, he took it away, and then gave it back. So you can still go. So he's asked. Shonaka has asked. He inquired about the conversation between Vidura and Maitreya. There must have been many narrations of the spotless pastimes of the Lord. The hearing of such narrations is exactly like bathing in the water of the Ganges, for it can free one from all sinful reactions. So here, in these next two verses, 5 and 6, there's a glorification of hearing. And it's interesting, the comparison, because Shonaka Rishi wants Sutta Goswami to repeat what about the conversation between Maitreya and Vidura. Why? Because he's saying there must have been Krishna Katha. There must have been talk about Krishna. And this Krishna Katha is exactly like bathing in the water of the Ganges. It frees one from sinful reactions. And it gives attraction to Krishna. So when people go to a pilgrimage place, the first thing they usually do is they want to bathe somewhere. And because there's a liberating feeling from that. There's some removal of sins, sinful reactions from that. But just see, this is what why Narottama Das Thakur recommends, hearing Krishna Katha, because the same result of being purified from sinful reactions takes place just by hearing about Uttama Sloka, Krishna. O Sutta Goswami, he continued, all good fortune to you. Please narrate the activities of the Lord, which are all magnanimous and worthy and worth glorifying. What sort of devotee can be satiated by hearing the nectarian pastimes of the Lord? Who can feel that they've heard enough? What kind of devotee? So the answer is, not a very good kind of devotee. So that's my situation. Prabhupada says, listen to this. Those who are on the transcendental platform, the narration of the pastimes of the Lord, which are always enacted on the transcendental platform, all of Krishna's activities there, they have nothing to do with the material world. They should be received with all respect by devotees. Those who are actually on the transcendental platform are never satiated by hearing the continuous narration of the pastimes of the Lord, like Parikit Maharaj. He's hearing for 7 days straight, no eating, no sleeping, no nothing, just hearing, wanting to hear more and more. For example, if any self-realized soul reads from Bhagavad Gita, he will never feel satiated. The narrations of Bhagavad Gita and Srimad Bhagavatam may be read thousands and thousands of times, and still, without fail, new aspects of the subject matter will be relished by the devotee. So Shonaka has asked Sutta, and Sutta begins to reply. Sutta Goswami, whose mind was absorbed in the transcendental pastimes of the Lord, just that simple phrase, his mind was absorbed in the transcendental pastimes of the Lord. Just how wonderful it would be. Just think of all the things that our minds are absorbed in day and night and day and night. Diva nishihiya jale judaite nakainu upai. Day and night our mind burns in anxieties because we are not absorbed in Krishna, in Krishna's pastimes, Krishna's names, Krishna's service. So Sutta said, please hear what I shall now speak. So he is telling Shonaka Rishi and the 10,000 sages to please listen attentively. Sutta Goswami continued, Vidura, the descendant of Bharat, was delighted to hear the story of the Lord, who, having assumed by his own divine potency the form of a boar, had enacted the sport of lifting the earth from the bottom of the ocean and indifferently killing the demon Hiranyaksha. Why indifferently? I mean, it was just a teeny insignificant part of his potency. They were fighting, and finally the Brahma and the sages said, please do it. They were in too much anxiety because the Lord was playing. He was having a good good time fighting, but they were in anxiety. So he just chopped them with his hoof on the side of the ear indifferently, killed them immediately. So the Lord had assumed the form of a boar, and he had enacted the sport of lifting the earth from the bottom of the ocean and indifferently killing the demon Hiranyaksha. Vidura then spoke to the sages as follows. Vidura said, so now Vidura, so we've gone from the middle level of the narration of Sutta speaking to Shonaka Rishi and the other sages, now going to the most immediate level. Vidura is speaking to Maitreya. Since you know of matters inconceivable to us, tell me, O holy sage, what did Brahma do to create living beings after evolving the Prajapatis, the progenitors of human beings? How did the Prajapatis, the progenitors of living entities such as Marichi and Swayambhuva Manu, how did they create according to the instructions of Brahma? And how did they evolve this manifested universe? So he's saying, basically, how did the creation go on? Did they evolve the creation in conjunction with their respective wives? Did they remain independent in their action? Because like the Lord, he created, Lord Gaudiya Vishnu created Brahma without the help of a wife. So did they have wives? Did they act independent? Or did they all jointly produce the creation? And Maitreya began to answer. Text 12. Maitreya Uvacha. He's going to start again from the very beginning of creation. But even though in the third canto, the creation will be described four times because it's an important subject matter. But then we won't hear about it again until a final review in the 12th canto, or actually in the 11th canto and then in the 12th again. So Maitreya said, when the equilibrium of the combination of the three modes of nature was agitated by the unseen activities of the living entity, by Mahavishnu and by the force of time, the total material elements were produced. So if you had heard the opening chapters in this canto, or the last canto, we heard how the Lord was there, and then by his glance, he impregnated the pradhan, or the primal material energy, which is compared to almost like a cloud covering Brahmajyoti. And with that glance, he injected the living entities along with their karma and the time factor within the material world, and then it began within that cloud. And then the creation begins from that. So I'll read this again. When the equilibrium of the combination of the three modes of material nature was agitated, so at this pradhan state, this cloud-like state, everything is undifferentiated. That means even though there's the three modes of material nature in there, but they're there in an undifferentiated form. But when the unseen activities, means the karma of the living entity, are injected in there with the living entities, with the force of time, by Mahavishnu, then the differences, it starts evolving. And so certain specific things are produced at that time. We'll read some of Prabhupada's purport. The cause of the material creation is described here very lucidly, clearly. The first cause is daiva, or the destiny of the conditioned soul, means our karma. The material creation exists for the conditioned soul who wants to become a false lord for sense enjoyment. One cannot trace out the history of when the conditioned soul first desired to lord it over material nature. But in Vedic literature, we always find that the material creation is meant for the sense enjoyment of the conditioned soul. There is a nice verse which says that the sum and substance of the conditioned soul's sense enjoyment is that as soon as he forgets his primary duty to render service to the Lord, he creates an atmosphere of sense enjoyment. So in that sense, he creates an atmosphere of sense enjoyment, which is called Maya, and that is the cause of the material creation. So in that sense, the living entity is a co-creator, not an independent creator, but the living entity is actually the creator of the material world. Just like the prisoners, in one sense, by their mentality, they create the atmosphere of a prison house, which is very repressive. It is their mentality that creates it. If there were no prisoners with prisoner mentalities, there would be no prison houses. So similarly, we cannot blame Krishna ultimately for anything, because it is our mentality, this dogged desire to independently enjoy. And no one is satisfied or happy in that way. But anyway, that Maya created by the mentality of the living entity is the cause of the material creation. It's an interesting angle on it. Another word used in this verse is durvitakena. No one can argue about when and how the conditioned soul became desirous of sense enjoyment, but the cause is there. That's a good answer to the question that we don't talk about where the soul came from, or etc., etc. Because no one can argue about it, how, when and where the conditioned soul became desirous of sense enjoyment. It is beyond. It's Bhaktivinoda Thakur describes its place. It is ununderstandable for a conditioned soul, because it's whatever happened, Krishna knows what it is and when it is, or if there's anything like that. But it happens beyond time. And how can we who are trapped within time conceive of what occurs beyond time? Material nature is an atmosphere meant only for the sense enjoyment of the conditioned soul, and it is created by the personality of Godhead. So Maitreya is replying, when he's asked how did the creation proceed by the Prajapatis, the sons of Brahma, he starts prior to that point in his explanation by explaining how Mahavishnu, he doesn't start as far back as the previous times. In the first description of creation, the beginning was, it just starts as Mahavishnu is alone. That's the emphasis. In this one, that's not the emphasis, so quickly move on. And then in the second one, there was a big description of the creation of the saga elements, the different elements of the combination of false ego and the three modes of material nature, and then which was produced from each of those combinations. But here he's going to quickly move past that. As impelled by the destiny of the jiva, the false ego, which is of three kinds, goodness, passion, ignorance, evolved from the mahatattva, in which the element of rajas, passion, predominates. From the ego, in turn, evolved many groups of five principles. So the Prabhupada's purport explains the groups of five principles, the five material elements, the five sense objects, the five knowledge-acquiring senses, the five working senses, like this. Separately unable to produce the material universe, they combined with the help of the energy of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. So in previous descriptions, there were the prayers of the demigods. Earlier on in this canto, where they asked for the Lord to help them. Although all the elements were there, all the ingredients were there, they themselves could not put the universe together. So they begged the Lord to do it, and then the Lord, as described here, combined, separately unable to produce the material universe, they combined with the help of the energy of the Supreme Lord and were able to produce a shining egg, the universe. For over 1,000 years, the shiny egg lay on the waters of the causal ocean in the lifeless state. Then the Lord entered it as Garbhadakshay Vishnu. So the super soul. He's the soul of the universe. He's called the Paramatma. He gives life to the universe. As we ourselves, the soul, gives life to the body. So because he gives, Gaudakshaya gives, Vishnu gives life to the universe, he is called the Paramatma. And because Karanadakshaya Vishnu gives life to the entirety of the material creation, he is also called Paramatma. And because Chiradakshaya Vishnu gives life to the soul who gives life to the body, he is also called Paramatma. So when the Gaudakshaya Vishnu entered the universe, from the navel of the personality of Godhead, Gaudakshaya Vishnu, sprouted a lotus flower, effulgent like a thousand blazing suns. This lotus flower is the reservoir of all conditioned souls, and the first living entity who came out of the lotus flower was the omnipotent Brahma. So he is called Haranyagarbha, which means basically the golden womb. The lotus is called Haranyagarbha sometimes. The stem is called Haranyagarbha, and sometimes Gaudakshaya Vishnu, and sometimes Brahma, I believe. These three are sometimes called Haranyagarbha. Yes? You know? No? You don't know? Okay. When that Supreme Personality of Godhead, who is lying on the Gaudak ocean, entered the heart of Brahma, Brahma brought his intelligence to bear, and with the intelligence invoked, he began to create the universe as it was before. So in the previous description, there was a lot of description of Lord Brahma and how he performed austerities, and how eventually the Lord was pleased with him, and then he enlightened him from within and gave him the inspiration to be able to create the universe. We'll read a little of Prabhupada's purport on this. Brahma was the first living entity, and he was empowered by the Supreme Lord to act in charge of the mode of passion. Therefore, he was given the required intelligence, which is so powerful and extensive that he is almost independent of the control of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Just as a highly posted manager is almost as independent as the owner of a firm, Brahma is described here as independent because, as the Lord's representative to control the universe, he is almost as powerful and independent as the Supreme Personality of Godhead. The Lord, as the Supersoul within Brahma, gave him the intelligence to create. The creative power, therefore, of every living entity is not his own. It is by the grace of the Lord that one can create. There are many scientists and great workers in this material world who have wonderful creative force, but they act and create only according to the direction of the Supreme Lord. A scientist may create many wonderful inventions by the direction of the Lord, but it is not possible for him to overcome the stringent laws of material nature by his intelligence, nor is it possible to acquire such intelligence from the Lord. For the Lord's supremacy would then be hampered. It is stated in this verse that Brahma created the universe as it was before. This means that he created everything by the same name and form as in the previous cosmic manifestation. So now we're going to hear about the Visarga creations. And we've already heard some of these previously. Now we hear more. Now, previously, we've heard that the creation began with the four Kumaras, Brahma's creation. And one of the last things that we heard about him creating was ignorance. But here, the first thing we're going to hear about him creating is ignorance. First of all, Brahma created from his shadow the coverings of ignorance of the conditioned soul. They are five in number and are called Tamisra, Andha Tamisra, Tamas, Moha, and Mahamoha. We'll hear about these five. We'll read Prabhupada's purport and then we'll stop. The conditioned souls, or living entities, who come to the material world to enjoy sense gratification, are covered in the beginning by five different conditions. Before we can try to enjoy our senses, we need coverings of ignorance. Because, and the getting the ignorance is Krishna's mercy, because this is what we want to enjoy, so he's giving us the facility to enjoy. As soon as we fully and completely give up this, the desire to be the enjoyer and the controller, Krishna takes away immediately all the ignorance. And then there is no ignorance, that means there is knowledge, and then we understand things in the proper perspective. So Prabhupada's going to now explain the five, and then the information actually comes from the Vishnu Purana. The first condition is a covering of tamizra, or anger. Constitutionally, each and every living being, entity, has minute independence. It is misuse of that minute independence for the conditioned soul to think that he can also enjoy like the Supreme Lord, or to think, why shall I not be a free enjoyer like the Supreme Lord? This is the first ignorance, tamisra. It's like an anger or envy of the Lord. Why should he be God when I am here? This forgetfulness of his constitutional position is due to anger or envy. Envy, there's envy in the heart to Krishna. And just imagine, say if we see someone who's really beautiful or something walking along, or we see someone who's very wealthy, or someone who's really intelligent, or someone who does something that we can't do, and we feel twinges of envy, or we sometimes feel full outblown envy, right? So if we're envious of some little insignificant fellow who has just a little bit of opulence, just a little teeny bit better than us, just imagine how envious we are of Krishna, who has everything. That's where it starts. So it's a forgetfulness of our constitutional position. The living entity, being an eternally a part and parcel servitor of the Supreme Lord, can never, by constitution, be an equal enjoyer with the Lord. When he forgets this, however, and tries to be one with him, his condition is called tamisra. Even in the field of spiritual realization, this tamisra mentality is hard to overcome. In trying to get out of the entanglement of material life, there are many who want to be one with the Supreme Lord. Even in their transcendental activities, this lower grade mentality of tamisra continues. So this is referring to Mayavadis and impersonalists. Under tamisra involves considering death to be the ultimate end. So first there's an enviousness of Krishna that provides a false ego, then identification with the body, which makes one think that the end of everything is when I die. The atheists generally think that the body is the self and that everything is therefore ended with the end of the body. Thus they want to enjoy material life as far as possible during the existence of the body. Their theory is, as long as you live, you should live prosperously. Never mind whether you commit all kinds of so-called sins. You must eat sumptuously, beg, borrow, and steal. And if you think that by stealing and borrowing, you are being entangled in sinful activities for which you'll have to pay, then just forget that misconception, because after death, everything is finished. No one is responsible for anything he does during his life. This atheistic conception of life is killing human civilization, for it is without knowledge of the continuation of eternal life. So even what religions in this world even understand the eternality of the soul? So that particular ignorance under tamisra makes us think that it's when the body is over, it's over. The curtain goes down. This under tamisra ignorance is due to tamas, The condition of not knowing anything about the spirit is called tamas. So misidentification with the body and thinking that when the body dies, that's a feeling we have. It's not just lack of knowledge. But so everyone feels this in the material world. Now the third one is tamas, is the cause of it. It's the ignorance, the thinking that, you know, when I die, I'm the body, basic identification of the body. And then the third one is the ignorance. Tamas. The material world is generally, under tamisra ignorance, is due to tamas. The condition of not knowing anything about the spirit soul is called tamas. This material world is also generally called tamas because 99% of its living entities are ignorant of their identity as soul. Almost everyone is thinking that he's the body. He has no information of the spirit soul. Guided by this misconception, one always thinks, this is my body, and anything in relationship with this body is mine. For such misguided living entities, sex life is the background of material existence. Actually, the conditioned souls in ignorance in this material world, tamas, are simply guided by sex life. And as soon as they get the opportunity for sex life, they become attached to so-called home, motherland, children, wealth, and opulence. And as these attachments increase, moha, or the illusion of the bodily concept of life, also increases. So then comes moha, after tama comes moha. Thus the idea that I am this body and everything belongs to this body is mine also increases. And as the whole world is put into moha, sectarian societies, families, and nationalities are created and they fight with one another. Maha moha means to be mad after material enjoyment. Especially in this age of Kali, everyone is overwhelmed by the madness to accumulate paraphernalia for material enjoyment. Shop until you drop. Just buy, consume, enjoy. Don't be satisfied with what you have. We're making progress. Get this year's model. Nothing is enough. Get more. Buy. Blah. Just continuously. That's what society sees as its goal, that's consuming, 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 producing and consuming, producing, consuming. And then Prabhupada explains that these definitions are given in Vishnu Purana. Okay, I'll stop here. Any questions? Thank you very much. Questions or comments? We'll try to finish the chapter tomorrow.
That seems quite significant in many different ways, because from the point of view of the impersonalist, in a fight between the Lord and the demon, and the word in the same image, it could be differently. It's like a pun. It could be something like a pun, perhaps.
None differently.
Yeah.
Because he was a...
Well, that is that everyone is one soul anyway.
Yeah.
And so that the Lord killed, it was given indifferently. And maybe a final word or something. And also that, because when the demon is killed by the Lord, he gets liberation. So generally the soul is seen flying or merging into the body of the Lord. So perhaps that might have some significance in different ways.
In none different ways. In different ways. Yes, you're getting new light from the Bhagavatam.
Does the word indifferent, does that
nonchalantly
imply the Lord's opulence and renunciation?
No. Yes, no. It seemed to me that it implied that it was insignificant. He was fighting with them, and the fighting was going on, and the demigods were afraid, right? So they were afraid that he was going to defeat the Lord. The Lord even dropped his club. We don't know if it ever landed, hit the ground. I remember that from the last class. But so the demigods became terrified. He said, don't play with him any longer. You know, we're in too much anxiety. Kill him. So he said, all right. And it was over. So it seemed to me it was more the opulence of his actual power was being shown than his renunciation. That, you know, with a flick of his wrist, basically, or his hoof. And he didn't even have to do that, really. Meant that it didn't take nonchalantly. Indifferent also means nonchalantly. So casually, not, as opposed to, okay, now I'm going to have, okay, you really want me to kill him, okay. You know, he rolls up his sleeves, or something like that. Okay, now I'm going to have to summon up all my strength and do it. Not like that at all.
So that almost implies that none of his strength is actually used when
you're killing him. Yes, exactly. I mean, just most insignificant. In other words, he could have killed 200,000 of them without any trouble, so don't be in anxiety. Because it's important for us to know this, because we become frightened. So Krishna can remove whatever it is that is bringing fear to us with just the tiniest insignificant portion of his potency. So we're taking shelter of the right person. That's the idea. We're getting a glimpse of what God is, who God is, what does it mean to be God? That he could appear in any way he wants, he can appear in any form he wants. He can do anything he wants. He's completely independent. And he has unlimited, unfathomable power. Excuse me. Just half a second. Because unless we have trust in his potency, how will we ever put ourselves in his hands, have the faith to do so? So these are faith-building exercises, so to speak. Not exercises, but we're coming to teachings. Yes, exactly. And knowledge building, because knowledge builds faith. And also the experience of associating with Krishna through associating with the Bhagavatam. Sorry.
Whatever approach Krishna at the same time might try to have to do with it.
Sorry, say that again?
Whatever at the time,
yes.
Whatever is approaching Krishna might try to have to be there also.
Not exactly, but Uddhava approached. Uddhava came first and then Maitreya came, inspired by Krishna.
So that inspiration was there for the Guru's benefit, or was Maitreya there for the Guru's
benefit? Maitreya's benefit. Yeah, he previously didn't understand that Vaikuntha was the ultimate goal of life. So Krishna decided to give him some mercy and change him from an impersonalist, a Brahmavadi basically, to a Vaishnava. So Krishna, when Krishna wants to give someone mercy out of his kindness, he generally does it through his devotees. But in this case, he decides to do it himself. Therefore, the devotees, as I said, to be sometimes called the Kripa Shakti of the Lord. They are carrying the internal energy, the mercy of the Lord, the compassion of the Lord. That's how Krishna exhibits his compassion. But that doesn't mean that he can't do it himself, but generally it's his devotees. In his commentary on Savadvam Pityaja, Mamekam Sharam Raja. I think Srila Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur explains Krishna's mind when he says, he tells Arjuna that generally speaking, I don't allow anyone to surrender to me directly. I have to surrender to my devotee. But you've so much melted my heart. then I will make an exception in your case. Actually speaking, surrender to Krishna means to surrender to the devotee, because that's what Krishna says to do. Hare Krishna. Good night. So we'll continue tomorrow if Krishna kindly allows. Srimad Bhagavatam.